Hi, friends. I'm Tim Whitaker, and welcome to the New Evangelicals podcast. The New Evangelicals is an inclusive, Jesus-centered community that holds space for people marginalized by the evangelical church, advocates for accountability in the church, and helps you explore the Christian tradition beyond the basement of evangelical fundamentalism. This podcast is part of that work, so join us as we talk to people from all walks of life, lending their expertise and wisdom to us as we renegotiate our faith and find better paths forward. Hello, friends. How are we doing? Welcome back to the show. Great to be with you. This is a phenomenal conversation. I brought on Sarah McCammon. She is the author of The Exvangelicals, Loving, Living, and Leaving the White Evangelical Church. Here's what makes this conversation so unique. Sarah is both an NPR journalist. Yes, that's my child screaming behind. I'm going to leave that in so you know that I'm a normal dude who has children. Sorry about that, but it is what it is. So Sarah is an NPR journalist and also an ex-evangelical. So she has the experience that so many of us have and also is a journalist who wrote about it. This is a great conversation. We cover some great topics, including her take on the ex-evangelical movement slash explosion as a whole, and if she thinks it's here to stay or not. So Sarah, thank you for coming on. Also, side note, I didn't even realize this, but I'm quoted in the book. I know. I felt so famous. I'm like, Sarah, I made it into your book. I am honored. So anyway, it is great just for you to be tuning in. I'm so grateful to have you here with us. I hope that you enjoy this interview. And of course, friends, I just want to give a personal, maybe take a personal moment just to say how grateful I am truly for all of you out there who listen. It blows me away. I hope that I communicate enough how much of an honor and a privilege it is to have your ears on our podcast. We are working behind the scenes to really develop the show more and more to try and bring you engaging content that hopefully helps you as you renegotiate your faith and find better paths forward in your faith. So yeah, just thank you for listening. If you want to help support the work that we do, honestly, sharing the podcast would be so helpful. Giving the podcast a rating and a review is also really helpful. And as many of you know, we are a nonprofit organization and we are committed to doing all of this work paywall free. And the reason why we're able to do that is because people donate. Right now, less than 1% of our entire audience across all of our social medias donate. And even with that amount of money, we were able to reach 20 million people last year, helping them find better paths in their faith and finding better paths forward when it comes to, you know, the Christian tradition and how they navigate that. So if you are willing and able, if you'd be willing to donate, it'd be so helpful. We are completely donor funded. 560 monthly donors make this work possible. You often now are hearing from some of them in the actual podcast episodes. And without them, this doesn't happen. So if you'd be willing, that would be so amazing. We are a nonprofit organization, which means that your donations are tax deductible. And by the way, I have discovered that if you're in Canada, that also applies to you, which I didn't know that till recently. But if you're in Canada and you donate, you're also eligible for a tax write-off. So anyway, thank you so much, friends, again, for supporting us. It means the world. I can't thank you enough. Without further ado, here is my interview with Sarah. I hope you enjoy it. Talk to you all later on.
Hi, my name is Carrie and I live in Kansas and I'm a monthly supporter of the New Evangelicals. I started supporting the New Evangelicals in 2020 when it became clear that the evangelical world that I had been raised in and was a part of was doing more harm than good. Since that time and since following the New Evangelicals, I've appreciated the variety of experiences and opinions that are shared on the platform, and I share the concern over the future and the trajectory of the evangelical church. I'm glad I'm able to support this platform and the content as we continue to offer a different voice in contrast to what's being told to us by the evangelical church. Thank you.
All right. I'm super excited. Sarah McCammon, it is great to have you on the podcast. Thank you for making time in what seems to be a very busy world of journalism for you. So thank you so much.
It is, but you're busy too. We're all busy. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. You wrote a book called The Exvangelicals, Loving, Living, and Leaving the White Evangelical Church. It's almost like you wrote a book for our audience, frankly. It's like, oh, that sounds familiar. Yeah, almost. And I'm really excited to kind of dig into this book with you and kind of gain some of your insights because you do have a very unique perspective where, you have come out of the evangelical movement in a lot of ways, but also you're a journalist. So you're able to kind of use those skills and tools to write a book that I'm assuming, because the book's not out just yet, but I'm assuming is part your story and part maybe your journalistic approach to just the movement as a whole. So I'm looking forward to digging into it. I mean, maybe the first question to get us kicked off is, for you, why write this book? Was it mostly personal, or were you just intrigued as a journalist about the evangelical explosion in general?
Well, I was like deconstructing, and I guess I was an evangelical before I knew those words existed. I mean, I'm in my early 40s. I'm 43. I'll just say it. And so I was born like, you know, at the very beginning of the Reagan era. I saw like the whole Clinton scandal unfold while I was a teenager. And then like as an adult, I kind of had my own early 20s, which was also like mid 2000s deconstruction, and became a journalist and like kind of thought I had gotten away from that world. And then I wind up covering the 2016 campaign and then sort of watching, you know, first professionally. And then, of course, I have this whole background in this world of white evangelicalism that has become so talked about and so influential. And I'm sort of watching the narrative around it and watching a lot of people who grew up like me having these very public conversations about this experience of figuring out what they believed, dealing with cognitive dissonance, all these things that I had been through and didn't have a language for at the time. And it seemed to me that some of these conversations were being catalyzed by the political moment we were in, but they weren't exclusive to it. You know, there was a lot going on there. And a lot of these conversations that were happening out in public were, they really resonated with what I had been through and was still going through to some extent, because I think, as we all know, deconstruction is a journey and probably a never ending one. So yeah. As a journalist, when I see something happening that feels like kind of a trend or a moment or a movement, I want to write about it. And I thought, wow, this is something that I know from the inside out. I know how it feels. So that was kind of how it came together. I started scratching out notes, I think around 2017, for something that would be kind of a hybrid of memoir and reporting, and just kept thinking about it and just kind of, you know, people, I used to hear writers talk about, like, I felt like this book was something I had to write, it had to come out. And I really began to feel that way. And so it was just a wonderful opportunity to reach out to like people I'd grown up with, people I met online. I don't know if you remember, but we talked a few years ago when I was chewing on this idea, and you're quoted in the book. And so we have...
I'm quoted in the book?
You haven't read the book yet, have you? Or you're mentioned, well, at least.
I have not gotten a copy of the book yet. And we're recording this before the release date. It's not March 19th. So no, I don't even know that. But I'm quoted in the book. Sarah, I'm honored. Thank you so much.
That's so funny. I did not realize you didn't have the book yet until we turned on this interview. And I'm like, okay, wow. So you're coming to this cold. But yes, it was people like you and people like Blake Chastain and all kinds of other people with, you know, a lower profile, and then people I'd met at parties and in my 20s and people I knew growing up. Like, I think if you leave the evangelical bubble, the evangelical subculture, there is like this, we all have our own stories, but we all have this kind of unifying similar experience. And I just really wanted to write about what that was and how it felt at this time, because it felt like the right time to talk about it.
I would agree with you, man. There's so many ways to go with this conversation. I mean, maybe we'll start here and we'll venture out into other territory, but just kind of on a personal level for you, what were some of the major ingredients that caused you to eventually leave that evangelical world? Like, I mean, most of my audience, especially on Instagram, is women. And I do hear a lot of similar themes. You know, maybe it's tales of misogyny, it's purity culture, it's modesty culture. And then for them, Trump was someone who they saw being emboldened and embraced by white evangelical men. And they went, oh, this just feels incredibly unsafe for me. Those ingredients kind of led to their journey out. Do you have a similar, you know, ingredient list, or were yours somewhat different? What's your story with that?
Sure. And I want to say mine had nothing to do with Donald Trump. I deconstructed long before that happened. But again, I think in that moment, I started seeing a lot of public discussion about what it meant to be evangelical, because everybody was talking about that all of a sudden, both inside and outside of the evangelical world. But for me, you know, the book really is kind of organized thematically around some of these what I call tension points or sources of cognitive dissonance that, you know, in order to hold at least some evangelical beliefs, you kind of have to create an infrastructure around them. You know, if you've never met somebody who isn't an evangelical Christian, it's a little easier to believe that, like, well, everybody else has it wrong. We have it right. We have the truth. And, you know, there are so many, I think, beautiful things in the Christian tradition, and the evangelical tradition is part of that. So, you know, there are so many reasons why we hold on to them and we want to share them. But, you know, until you're really faced with somebody who is different and doesn't fit into kind of that framework, that framework is really important for kind of holding, I think, for holding that small little bubble in place. And I describe, you know, my framework, my parallel universe was Christian school, going to church all the time, going to Christian camp, having just this whole world of books and magazines and Christian music and Christian videos, which I know we all, so many of us have probably seen and were part of. I didn't realize that I was in a subculture. I thought mm-hmm. I was, you know, we just talked about being Christians and needing to share the truth with the world. And so for me, there were many different points along the way, as there probably are for lots of people, that kind of challenged that belief system. But one of the central characters in this book is my grandfather, and he kind of provided, in many ways, a foil for everything that I was being taught and this whole sort of carefully constructed framework that was built around me through white evangelicalism. My grandpa was secular. He was not religious. And as I write about in the book, he, after my grandmother passed in the early 80s, he came out as gay as about a 60-year-old. And that wow. happened at the same time. It's 1984. It's the midst of the AIDS crisis. The moral majority is on the rise. And my parents are hardcore all-in evangelicals. So this created tremendous tension in my home, tremendous cognitive dissonance for me. And it was really, I think, the first crack in the armor that kind of showed me that, like, there are other ways of thinking and there are other ways of living. And I write a lot in the book about the real pain and anguish I went through as a child trying to make sense of that. And then that was a process that really took many, many years for me to make sense of. Again, I think everybody's specific moment of fracture or moments are different. But the thing that I think, as I interviewed other ex-evangelicals, we all had in common was, like, something or some things happened that made me go, I just cannot keep holding these beliefs. Like, I, you know, whatever good there is in them, I have to shift my thinking. I have to explore these questions.
I totally agree. I was 18 working at Starbucks, my first real job. And my coworker, his name is Joey. That was his nickname, not his legal name, so I can say it. He was gay. And at first I was like, oh my God, I've been warned about the gays, you know, like my family, my church tradition has warned me that these people are, insert all the stereotypes here. And we became quite friendly, and he was nothing like what was described to me in my evangelical bubble. And we kept in touch for a long time, even after we stopped working together. In fact, every now and then he'll message me still because he sees the work I've been doing online. And it was through a long series of endless Facebook comment wars and him eventually telling me his story that when he was in youth group, he was 13 and came out to his pastor that he was struggling with his sexuality. And his youth pastor called him an abomination and told him never to come back. And yeah. Joey's telling me this story and I'm weeping over my keyboard and I'm thinking, this doesn't add up. Like, something doesn't make sense that Joey could have this experience, but I never thought about that because that's never happened to me. But Joey's also nothing like what this tradition taught me. Something isn't lining up. And I think that for people listening, they all have their Joey moment or maybe their mm-hmm. grandfather moment, right? Where there was something that broke through that really well-constructed house that has no windows. But a right. beam of light broke through somewhere that made someone go, I don't know, maybe there's something beyond the mm-hmm. rooms that I'm occupying. So I totally agree with you on that. Was there any, for you, I'm just kind of curious, anything with like purity culture or modesty culture, misogyny, were any of those layers as well as you started getting older and realizing, hey, this also isn't fitting the mold? I mean, you mentioned Bill Clinton, that whole scandal kind of happening. Were any of those ingredients as well that kind of led you out of that basement?
For sure. And I kind of, as I sort of alluded to, I organized the book around these themes. And so there are chapters on purity culture, on religious trauma, on evangelical parenting and discipline, definitely on LGBTQ experiences and on race and also science. You know, I grew up. Yeah. I mean, that was another huge source of cognitive dissonance for me, just realizing that there was a whole world that believes some, you know, I kind of knew people who knew something about it believed differently than we did. And I struggled with that. So yeah, I mean, and what I did was I kind of wove some of my own, many of these moments in with the stories of people I, again, knew. Like I interviewed my brother, I interviewed you. I interviewed people who've written books, and then just regular people I found on social media, on Facebook groups, on Twitter, on Instagram, who agreed to be interviewed. Of course, I didn't quote anybody in private groups without their permission. Right. But I would see, I was in these spaces because I was interested, and I would see people say interesting things. And I kind of pulled together this kind of picture in my mind of what are these major sticking points for people and how do they process them? And so it was fascinating and really kind of cathartic to do all these interviews and just be reminded, like, you know this in your work, that these experiences, there's a degree of universality about it. And there's a common feeling of sort of disillusionment, confusion, fear, but also like excitement and exhilaration of trying to make sense of the world really as it is.
One of the hardest parts for me in this work is remembering that my experience is not the only evangelical experience, meaning, you know, I grew up a little more on the Reformed John MacArthur side. And so my fundamentalist upbringing is slightly different than some of my more Pentecostal friends who grew up in the Pentecostal fundamentalist side. Like, it's weird because evangelicalism is a subculture, but there are also subcultures inside of that subculture, right? So was it challenging for you as a journalist to find the balance and also even just the information between your experience in that space, but also the broader subculture that maybe you never experienced, but were discovering as you were interviewing all these different people?
Yeah, I thought a lot about that, like how to define terms and what to include. And I kind of settled on this idea of theologically conservative Protestantism. The fact is, and I think you know this, that these different movements overlap and cross-pollinate in such profound ways. And that, there is a shared, I keep saying culture, but also there is shared media, shared books, I think Dr. Dobson and Focus on the Family is probably one of the most universal things that if you were an evangelical kid, there's a good chance you grew up with some influence from James Dobson. Even Bill Gothard, I'm sure a lot of us watched the Shiny Happy People documentary. And the thing that I have talked about and others have talked about is that you didn't have to grow up in ATI or IEBLP or under the influence of Bill Gothard specifically to be influenced by that thinking. Like, my church had a Gothard phase and we were kind of into it. But there were other people that were totally into it. But these ideas all kind of exist in this ecosystem. And so I'm sure that one of the criticisms of the book from people from the evangelical world will be, well, that's just your experience. It's not everybody's. And that is true. But that's part of why I talked to dozens of people and I quoted primary sources. I quote from, Christian school textbooks and from literature from the last 30, 40 years and beyond, from people like, James Dobson and Tim LaHaye and others who sort of formed the intellectual ecosystem that we all grew up in. Because I wanted to try to describe as much as possible and identify what that world was, what that subculture was, where it came from, and what it felt like and looked like. And so, no, there is no universal experience, but I think there is a culture and there are shared experiences. And I think that's why people come together online with these hashtags and want to talk about it, because it's like, oh, we went through something really analogous and, we can kind of unpack that together, even if we may have arrived or landed in different places as a result.
I think that's well said. I certainly struggle with the term evangelical is so slippery. I mean, even scholars, right, like Kristen Dumais will tell you that there's a theological way to define evangelicalism. Then there's this cultural way. Evermore, it's kind of turning into a political label more than a theological label. And the history of evangelicalism in America is quite complicated. A great book on this is The Other Evangelicals by Isaac Sharp. Point is that like it's not like a dictionary definition of like, okay, here it is. And now everyone agrees on that. Even evangelicals within disagree with each other. And then you're right though. It's such a weird paradox where it can be distinct and yet have such massive intersections at the same time, right? One example of this is like Bethel Music. Bethel Music, which comes out of a very charismatic, some might even argue New Apostolic Reformation type of theology, Seven Mountain Mandate, Dominionism kind of vibe. that music will reach into churches that are much more reformed and cessationist, meaning they don't believe in the gifts of the Spirit anymore. So there is a cross-pollination, even if it's coming from a very distinct section of the evangelical tradition, right? So it's fun to kind of unpack this with someone who is a journalist and also has the experience, because I have found that it's usually one or the other, right? Either I'm talking to a journalist who was just really curious and never understood the world, so they're writing about it, which is cool. Or I'm talking to folks who are like birthed and steeped in that world and now are deconstructing. And so it's cool to have the both and in you and in your book, that's kind of doing the work of both, where you totally get the culture, but also you have these tools that you've learned as a journalist to help other people understand in a more palatable way what it's actually like being inside of that space.
And I lean heavily in my book on the research of other people. Like I quote from the other evangelicals, I quote you, I quote Kristen Cobas-Dume and so many others. I mean, there's been so much excellent scholarly work done.
Agreed.
There's been a fair amount of memoir. And I think what's a little bit different about mine is the blend. But I really, you know, because I am a journalist, I guess two things. I felt like something was happening, to kind of go back to the beginning of our conversation. I was seeing these conversations happening and I felt like it was something that was worth writing about. I figured somebody was going to write about it and I kind of wanted it to be somebody who knew something, you know, from the inside. I have no problem with outsiders writing about us, but I think there's value. I mean, I really enjoyed Tim Alberta's book, and I think there's value in people who kind of speak the language and are fluent in the culture and understand the nuances, being a big part of that conversation. As a journalist, I didn't want to just tell my story though. Like, I wanted to tell my story in conversation with a lot of other people's stories. And so, you know, that's really what I've tried to do.
Let me ask you this. I've always wanted to ask a journalist this question, because I have this perception in my head of, obviously, you know, we track Christian nationalism a lot, and a lot of the work that we do is trying to help people, especially folks outside of evangelicalism, understand like, hey, here's what's going on. Here's where so much of this stuff is coming from. And one of the, I'm not going to call it a critique, but one of my concerns sometimes, right, is when it comes to quote unquote secular media sources, you know, NPR, ABC, CNN, whatever, I do appreciate that Christian nationalism is being talked about more and more. Sometimes though, I'm concerned that the people who are covering it don't understand the level of maybe militant fundamentalism that drives the religious side of it. And I'm thinking about, like, for you as a journalist in your world, do you think a lot of even more secular journalists are kind of maybe starting to understand that, you know, okay, this is really a religious underpinning that drives so much of, like, you know, maybe the world of Trump and the Turning Point USA mantras and maybe that more farther right political stuff? What's your take on that? I've always been curious from a journalistic standpoint.
I think a couple things. One, I think there is a growing understanding of it. I think people are curious, particularly because we have become as a country so politically polarized, you know, the increasing sort of intensifying alignment between the white evangelical movement and this political project that, you know, may or may not have anything to do with what Jesus Christ would have wanted to do. I mean, it's such a sort of anachronistic question, but, you know, what kind of America would Jesus have wanted? I mean, it's like, the question doesn't make any sense really if you think about it, but that's kind of what's happened. So that's going on. And I think people are more aware of it and therefore more curious. And I do think that you can call it the ex-evangelical movement or the post-evangelical movement, or just the fact that there are today so many more people who are adults, full grown old people in our 40s who know this world inside and out. I mean, there are a lot of people now who've graduated from evangelical institutions, spent time in the evangelical church, who are journalists, either mainstream journalists or doing things like you're doing, you know, podcasting, talking about it. I think that has an influence, or historians like Kristen Cobas-Dume. And I think that literacy in this world is informing the conversation in some way. But yeah, I mean, I have at times in my career been frustrated with trying to explain to my colleagues who don't have that context just what things mean and why it's important. And that's, you know, that's understandable. People don't have knowledge that they don't have. But I do wonder, as time goes by and as more and more people with a background in this world sort of get out into the world doing work like ours, if that will help sort of inform the public, I hope that it will, about, you know, where some of these ideas come from and what they mean.
Yeah. I mean, listen, as a journalist, I understand you have obligations, and me as a podcaster, I don't so much, right? I can just kind of say whatever I think on a personal level. And I've become more and more convinced that people in the world I have been birthed in and now who have moved on to other spaces really have an obligation to help other people who never were a part of it understand, you know, how serious these folks take their faith. Maybe that's a really charitable way of saying it. I call it religious fundamentalism or militant fundamentalism. But I think that sometimes there are people out there who are like, well, you know, Trumpism is like a political movement. I'm like, well, I agree, but there's a foundation here that is incredibly religious, and it comes from, a lot of it comes from the Christian evangelical world. And of course, we can trace this back to the roots of the moral majority and kind of laying the groundwork for what we're experiencing now. But it seems like, at least from my vantage point, and you don't have to comment on this at all, I'm making the comment that on my end, I get concerned about like what my tradition has produced over time politically and how that has concerned me. So I think a lot of the ex-evangelical movement, we can say, right, has kind of woken up to that and been like, wait a second. And Trump was a huge litmus test for this, right? Like, I mean, I was someone who at the time was still serving in my evangelical church. I was a drummer. I was still all in. And I always had concerns about just different things. You know, like, oh, well, why are we always waging war on Starbucks for Christmas? I don't understand, but I can get past that. And then Trump happens and I'm like, whoa, I'm really confused, because the people who raised me on like this sexual purity ethic of like, hey, don't have sex until you're married, and a good man is someone who's the husband of one wife, and yada, 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 is now telling me that I'm in the wrong because I can't support this guy who's voting, who's on the cover of Playboy magazine and, you know, grabbing women. So I think a lot of people, and I'm 35, so I'm not that far behind you, you know, but for me, it was that moment where I went, oh, something is not adding up to a level that I can no longer ignore or explain away as being just, you know, a little annoyance of my evangelical culture. It was like, oh my gosh, something seems really wrong. So I think a lot of folks woke up around that time. And then with the Black Lives Matter movement and the COVID response, it was kind of like the unholy trinity of things that made us go, okay, guys, I thought because we shared the same beliefs, we had the same values. Clearly we don't. And so now what do we do? And I think that's where a lot of the ex-evangelical movement, especially in the more recent couple of years, gets birthed out of.
No, that makes a lot of sense. And I mean, something that I try to sort of paint a picture of in my writing is this idea that these ideas didn't come from nowhere. They didn't just emerge a few years ago. And, you know, this is one of the reasons why I pulled my old textbooks and some of these old books that really have shaped a lot of evangelical thought, because these sort of patriarchal ideas, skepticism of science, skepticism of academic authority, skepticism of institutions, skepticism of government, a sense that Christianity is under attack, something that Kristen Cobos-Dume writes about really well. All of those ideas, and the idea that America is a Christian nation chosen by God and specially ordained to be a Christian nation, and that looks a certain way, all of those ideas are not new. They were baked into my childhood. They were baked into my textbooks. They were baked into the books that I were around my home. They seemed totally normal to me at that time.
Totally.
And I see the fruits of those ideas everywhere now. And I do think it's important to understand them. And, you know, I think for people who want to maintain some type of connection to their Christian faith, if that's where they choose to go, and I don't in any way, this isn't just because I'm a journalist, it's just not the kind of person that I am. I don't in any way weigh in on where people should land. I just don't feel like that's not my interest or, and I don't have that kind of wisdom or authority. So I don't, you know, I am equally happy to have this conversation with people who have wound up atheists, who've converted to a different religion, or to people who are still deeply Christian and love Jesus, but have reframed the way they think about it. I think all of those paths are interesting and very, very authentic and sincere for the people that follow them. And so, but whatever that is, for those who want to, particularly to want to maintain a connection to Christianity, though, I think it's important to disentangle, like, what is Christianity? What is Jesus? And what is, you know, maybe some 20th century political project that, again, may or may not have any real relationship to the essence of the faith. I'm not here to say to weigh in on that one way or another. It's something I think about a lot, but I think that journey and that sort of unraveling and deconstructing is like, it's a scary process, but it is, to me, such a fascinating one. And that's why I wanted to write about it. and explore it in conversation with other people, you know?
Yeah. I have found that in my conversations, I mean, it's hard to know. I'm guessing I've gotten over the past couple of years about 10,000 DMs. I mean, so I'm not saying that as an authoritative source. I'm just saying that's my best guess. And I talked to a lot of people is my point. And I've kind of labeled I call it the unholy trinity of deconstruction. I call it like, it's the three B's. It's bad theology, it's bad church, it's bad politics. Like those are the three categories that I have found most people find an avenue through when it comes to them having to renegotiate their faith or whatever it is. I'm curious, as you interviewed people for the book, did you find hints of, you know, those three things, or was one more predominant than the other? What was the experience that you were gaining from people as you were talking to them?
Yeah, I think it was all of the above. I think there were people who were, like you said, disillusioned with the political moment for sure. There was a lot of pain around things that had happened in churches, whether it was abuse or the way abuse was responded to, or, you know, just some of the more personal experiences that we've touched on. I mean, the impact of purity culture, for example, like the way that I think a lot of people, particularly women that I've spoken to and that others have interviewed, there are a couple of really good books out there, and I didn't want to reinvent the wheel, but I definitely felt like I needed to touch on purity culture. But just to take that as one example, the way that it shapes your thoughts about yourself, your body, your sexuality, and even as a woman, especially your role in the world, you know, your place in 100%. Society and the church, those can be very painful. And I think harmful. And I tried to, and you know, just to stick with that topic for a second, purity culture, I tried to acknowledge in the fact that a lot of our parents bought into those ideas with really good intentions. They wanted to protect us from pain, and you know, there is no avoiding pain in this world. And sometimes really rigid structures get built to try to protect people from something that's seen as worse. And so, you know, that too, I think, is part of the deconstruction process. Is it's like figuring out what you think, figuring out what you're going to keep and what you're going to transform or reject. And then also, I think, just kind of coming to peace with both yourself and your family and your, you know, the community you've come from as much as possible. And I think that is like, for me, that's been the work of getting a little bit older. It's like, okay, I can move on from what I was taught. I can be my own person, but I also need to like do this work of not being bitter, trying not to be angry, you know, trying to maybe to use a Christian word, forgive in a sense. But yeah, I think all of those are important factors, and it just depends on the individual, you know, which one's doing the work, but it's probably some combination for most people. I mean, what do you think? What do you think is doing most of the work in terms of initiating?
It's a combo of those three, you know? I mean, I think they all intersect in different ways, you know? I would say I talked to people who were like, the theology of hell, like the idea, you know, I was taught that I was predestined to either go to heaven or hell, and that if I was saved, I was predestined to go to the good place, and my friends weren't, you know, like, how does that work? Right. So I think that there was just bad theology. Obviously there's so much rampant, unaccountable church abuse happening. I mean, you know, the SBC story, most recently with Paul Pressler, what's happening at IHOP, International House of Prayer, with Mike Bickle. There's
my hometown.
Okay, great. Well, that's good to know. Yeah. So, I mean, and that story, I have inside sources that have told me it will only get worse. Like, I think that there's more to come from that, you know, and it's already only gotten worse over time. So you have that. And of course the political nature. And also I would argue from my vantage point, you know, the politics of even me marching for the March for Life as a teenager with my pro-life sign, even those things have shifted so farther right. The abolition movement, that's what it's called internally, this idea that, hey, we have to abolish abortion everywhere and also punish the mothers who have an abortion and also punish the doctors who give one. I mean, there are people like Jeff Durbin, who's from Apologia Radio, who's helped introduce legislation, I believe in South Carolina. It got rejected, but it would essentially treat abortion as homicide and therefore allow the mother to be eligible for the death penalty if she got an abortion. I mean,
was that the North Carolina bill in 2002?
Yes, thank you. North Carolina. Yep. Jeff Durbin was one of the people behind that bill. You know, that's the abolitionist movement. So, and again, like my pro-life days That was never a conversation. Like, I can't think about one time ever where someone's like, you know what we should do? We should make it so bad that we kill women who have abortions. Like, that was never on the table. So, like, I do think that I have watched even my own tradition only descend further into like an arena that makes me only more and more uncomfortable. So I definitely think all three of those play a factor and definitely have some overlap.
One question I have about that is just how, you know, today with the internet, with social media, we can hear every sort of fringe idea, whether mm-hmm. or not it's representative of the mainstream, and how much is that what's going on, and how much has the movement shifted. But I do think, you know, those types of bills have been proposed or they've been discussed at least. And I don't really have an answer to that, but it's a question I have is like, how much of a faction of the movement is that today?
I truly am no journalist. And I mean that quite literally. My hot take would be right now from the worlds I follow and the accounts I follow, there definitely is a battle happening in the pro-life movement of you have your more typical pro-lifers who are like, these people are fringe and crazy. But I will say that there is a growing, even if it's still small, movement of people who are like, no, this makes sense. So like, there are actual names of people who used to be Turning Point contributors who are public figures. Like, for example, Johnny Root. He's a public name, so I can say him on the air. I've met him before. He's in that camp now. And I've watched him kind of shift to that perspective of, well, yeah, if this is murder, then the person who commits a murder should be tried for murder, kind of logic, you know? And there's other accounts too that I've watched say that. Now, again, this could be still fringe, but my guess is that it will only get more traction over time in the more fundamentalist sects. Because to be fair, if you see abortion as murder, it is a logical conclusion to then think, well, the person who performed that action and the person who allowed it are then complicit in murder. So I actually think that they're being more consistent logically with that stance, which to me also scares me about how this idea could take off over time. But I mean, we're not here to talk about abortion all the way, but that's just like one example of me noticing some trends and some people that I followed kind of shift even their own perspective in real time from point A to now point B.
To me, Spencer Helms, the author of Faith Unleavened, and I'm super excited about Project Amplify, not only because I get to join my homie Tim in this endeavor, but because it's been time for a long time for those of us who've become convinced that God is not a weapon, that nobody owns our story of faith or theology, to become resourced enough to push back against harmful, dehumanizing narratives that are being touted in the name of Christianity and in the name of Jesus. So would love for you all to click this link and join us trying to turn the tide and take back some of the narrative about faith and about God. See you there.
One thing I wanted to talk about with you, which honestly, when I saw it, I was like, yes, I would love to dive into this, is this idea of maybe debunking the concept that ex-evangelicals are uniformly anti-religion or anti-Christian. And I actually want a lot of your thoughts on this, because I have told people in my audience that while deconstruction is an explosion, people go in all different directions and some certainly completely deconvert. Maybe they go to atheism or agnosticism or a different religion. My read on the pulse, and I could be off, is that many who deconstructed or who are now ex-evangelicals actually still want some form of their faith maintained for their personal life and live that experience. They just don't know where to go and how to rethink about those things. Give me your take on this. Like, was that your experience in the interview? How do you read the ex-evangelical movement when it comes to finding religion again?
I mean, that's absolutely my take, is that there's a huge variety. And, you know, I would say the people I talk to, many of them, and I didn't like do a tally or anything, but anecdotally, at least, many of them wanted to maintain some kind of connection to their faith, whether it was calling themselves a Christian still, or just to say, you know, I'm not sure, but I want to hold on to some piece of it, or I'm still figuring it out. I would hear things like that. Some people asked me not to say exactly where they'd landed, because it might be different than someone in their life, or they were still unsure. And so, yeah, there's a whole variety. I went to kind of an ex-evangelical church in Nashville for one scene in the book. and spent time with people there. And the pastor there, Josh Scott.
I knew you were going to say him? Josh Scott. I knew it. That's like the only evangelical progressive church I know of in Nashville. So I was like, it's got to be Josh Scott's church.
But I mean, those kinds of churches didn't, I guess there've always been, you know, progressive mainline churches.
Yeah.
And then there were like the seeker sensitive evangelical churches in the 90s. But those were really, I think, about trying to make people fundamentally embrace evangelical theology. Whereas, you know, Josh's church was really just like a gathering place for people with some interest in Christianity, I would say. I mean, that would be my sense of it. And so, so we spent time together at his church and spent time with one of the families in his church. And we talked about a lot of these things. But that's just one example. You know, I write in my book about, you know, I'm in an interfaith marriage now. So I spend probably more time in synagogues than I do in churches, but I still go to church sometimes. With at Christmas, I went with my kids, my husband, my ex-husband, and his partner. So like, you know, like we all kind of arrive in different places, and that's fine. But I don't think that everybody is turning into an atheist. I mean, and I know people, I have friends who are atheists, and that's fine. You know, I get like some people don't believe in God, and I'm not here to tell them that they should, but that's not me. And that's not a lot of people. Just because you leave evangelicalism or an evangelical church doesn't mean that you're not still interested in those topics. And I think that, at least speaking for myself and probably a lot of us, I would imagine, when you grow up in the church and you're always thinking about like what is right and what is wrong and who is God and how do you please God and what does God want us to do and how do we treat each other? Like, I think those are great questions that evangelicalism taught us to think about. And I'm glad I think about those things. I just, you know, struggle to feel like the answers that I was provided with had it all locked down. And I, you know, kind of want permission to continue to explore. So I don't know if that answers your question, but I think there's a variety. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, 100%. I share the same sentiment overall. You know, even like the rise of the nuns. That's a big thing now, like in the culture, right? People are shedding their religious labels and identifying as nun. But even if you go deeper, like the work that Ryan Burge has done on this, you know, he shows that like about half of those people, if not more, still have some kind of spirituality, identity, or some kind of spiritual label to themselves. And I think it's more about that than it is about like just completely leaving religion behind 100%. And again, I want to be clear. I know a lot of atheists listen to the show, and hopefully they know by now I respect that journey. I totally understand. And certainly, like, I don't think it's a moral judgment whether you stay or whether you go. I get that. But like, statistically, most people throughout human history, for whatever reason, are kind of bent towards having some kind of religious or sense of the divine or God or something beyond them. And so I think a lot of people, especially, you know, when you're 4 years old and you're in church, those beliefs take some deep roots in your brain. And I've told people before, like, listen, white evangelicalism radicalized me, and I'm just not ready to like get rid of all of that and try and rebuild a whole new belief system. Like, I'm 35. You know, I've been married for 7 years. I don't want to date again. Like, I did that. I don't want to have to find a whole new thing and like learn all of the nuts and bolts and find out about all the problems that tradition has. You know, like, I'm just kind of, okay, that's just not for me to do. So I think a lot of people might resonate with that kind of idea of like, I'm already so far in. The person of Jesus is still attractive to me. The Christian tradition is bigger than I thought. Maybe there's more to explore than just completely leaving the house. And I think that is why, and this is kind of the question I wanted to get to with this, is the direction of like Christianity in general in America and how ex-evangelicalism or the ex-evangelical movement plays into reshaping Christianity. Because if there's one thing I've learned by reading like Isaac Sharp's book, The Other Evangelicals, while there always have been remnants of like people trying to push things forward in this space, they tend to lose long term, right? Like, the conservative evangelical world is really well funded, really well networked. What do you think the impact of the ex-evangelical movement is on the Christian tradition in America regarding evangelicalism in that whole world? Do you think it's like a permanent, you know, shaping, or do you think it's a blip and conservative gatekeepers are just waiting to wait it out, et cetera?
I think that, like, I don't have the answer. I can only speculate, and I'm not going to speculate too much because why? But I'll just say this. I've been reading this book called Strange Gods, A Secular History of Conversion by Susan Jacoby. It's about 8 years old. I don't know if you've ever read it, but it's really about mostly about forced conversion, because that's what happened in a lot of the world. And of, you know, Christianity, Islam, and a little bit Judaism, although not nearly as much. And we're talking Catholics to Protestants, Protestants to Catholics, you know, all that good stuff and not good stuff at all. But I'm reading, the section I was reading actually just last night was about the rise of Protestantism. And there was this passage that was about like looking at, I think, letters between family members who had like left the Catholic Church and those who'd become Protestant. And or I think it was actually like a dialogue. This was like a pamphlet that had been, check me on all of this. But the essence of it was at that time, there was the printing press was, you know, generating this explosion of new thought. Everybody was reading the Bible for themselves and Protestantism was spreading and different subsects of Protestantism were arguing with one another about what they were going to be. And the thing that stuck with me was that families were divided by this, you know, like there was a story about, and I think it was sort of like a, you know, a fictionalized version, but it was about this, these two sisters, one was a nun and one was not, and she was converting to Protestantism, and they were writing back and forth about just like, you know, the peril of their souls basically. And I thought, well, like, this isn't that different. I mean, today it's not the printing press, it's the internet. And so there's this explosion of new ideas and there's a lot of like just angst around them, you know, like what's the right one and whose soul's in jeopardy. And I mean, I don't think that most ex-evangelicals are worried about other people's souls, but like there's definitely tension in families, right?
Oh, yeah. And definitely.
And sometimes definitely. A lot of pain and a lot of hand wringing. And so I'm not really answering your question except to say like, this isn't the first time that there's been an upheaval in religious thought, not by a long shot. And I think that a lot of this is only possible because of the internet. And I think maybe it's not history repeating itself. I don't want to completely compare it to like the Protestant Reformation and the internet and the printing press. But I do think that the internet is like galvanizing a whole lot of change and turnover and discussion. You know, it was one thing in the 1990s to have like a few books written by people who'd left their churches. But mostly if you left your church, you were a backslider, a sinner, somebody to be pitied or guarded against. Today, like there is a whole world out there of people you can talk to and find community with virtually or otherwise. And so I think that is changing things. I think also our country is just becoming much more, the United States at least is becoming so much more diverse and our globe is more global. And so there is more of a cross-pollination and exchange of ideas than ever before. And I think that has an impact on the way people view their faith. You know, if you look at the data about the nuns that you were just referencing, more and more people are not identifying, as you say, with a specific religion. But I agree with you, this spirituality project, you know, this like looking for something bigger thing is a thing that humans do. And, you know, whether it's rational or not, we do it, most of us.
Right.
And so, you know, I don't know where it lands. I really don't. But I think it's a fascinating time.
I don't know where it lands either. People ask me, is this a new reformation? I'm like, well, I know they say every 500 years, something big shifts with, you know, religions, and we're pretty much due. Also, you know, condensing, you know, 500 years into 1 year of change isn't really how that works, right? It takes a few decades for us to look back and say, oh yeah, that whole era was really when the shift happened. I do agree with you when it comes to social media. I think that's the game changer this time around. Certainly there have been movements before in the 20th century. But when everyone has a platform online and people can be found and people can hear themselves and people's stories, and there's so many, I mean, it just seems like there's an avalanche of people who are asking the questions that they were never allowed to ask, or more importantly, coming to different answers than they were allowed to come to. It makes me feel like this ex-evangelical deconstruction thing, at a minimum, has set something into motion. I'm not sure if the word we're going to use in 5 years from now is ex-evangelical or deconstruction, but the spirit behind it, the spirit behind renegotiating our faith, finding better ways forward in our faith, or even just shifting from a type of fundamentalism of just, you know, almost the illusion of certainty, right? Like, oh, I have this objective truth that I know for sure this is how it works when we die, and you just got to pray the prayer and become a Christian and you're all good. Like that kind of certainty, it starts to evaporate as you start to interrogate its claims. So I think and I hope that this is the beginning of some kind of major shift in evangelicalism. But I also know that the systems that are currently, you know, built are very entrenched and have a lot of networks, and they're really well funded, and they're also really good at communicating what they believe in very compelling ways on the surface, at least. So it's going to be very interesting to see how it all plays out, because our culture is more polarized than ever, arguably. Religion, Christianity is shifting so much. Religion is shifting so much. Globalization is the thing. Like, you're right. All these factors are playing a unique role in how we understand the world. I mean, and to your point about science earlier, right? We're discovering just how infinitely massive the universe and that universe and that universe and that galaxy is, right? I mean, when we're getting images of light that's billions of years old, it's like, oh my gosh, like how big is this thing that we're a part of that goes beyond us? That also plays into how we view God, you know, and it becomes a little more difficult to believe that, you know, out of billions of galaxies and maybe even trillions of them, you know, God really cares about, like, you know, you making sure you pray the right prayer before you die. Is that how that works? Like, is it that focused? You know, or that God cares if you masturbate? It's like, is that what God really cares about? Out of all the issues going on, this is the thing. So I think a lot of people are just thinking about it in that term as well.
Yeah, it is fascinating. I don't know where it goes, but I, you know, if we can say one thing about world history and religious history, it's that religion is always evolving and it's always shifting and in flux and incorporating new ideas. I mean, you know, I'm sure you have also studied the history of Christianity, and there's a lot of syncretism that was baked into that, you know, absorbing of ideas from surrounding peoples and then developing them and then arguing amongst ourselves and often quite a bit worse, which is, right. I think, an important sort of instructive. Yeah, I think this is part of why I like to read about religious history, because like it kind of makes like my particular place in it and my own specific beliefs, whatever they may be, feel a little less important when you understand like the vastness, not just of the universe, but also of like human thought and belief. And it also is a good reminder that like, I think, you know, if there's any position I will take, it is that religion and ideology should be, you know, religion can be a very powerful and beautiful tool, but I think it's clear it can also be a very dangerous one. And we should be careful about the melding of certain, you know, ideologies that espouse to have certainty about these questions that are very hard to have certainty about and sort of use, I'm not saying this very well, but what I'm talking about is the weaponization, I think, of religion and ideology, you know, using it as a tool to gain power and oppress people and tell other people how to live their lives and how to think, that has never worked out very well. And so I think, you know, if we look at not just evangelicalism, but the history of the world, there are lots of cautionary tales. And so I think that these conversations are important, and I hope that, you know, that we can proceed with respect. Right. If there's anything that I hope that evangelicals will take away from this book, it is just like empathy and understanding that these journeys are journeys people are on for a whole lot of reasons and often are prompted by a whole lot of pain. And they're very rarely, if ever, about, you know, trying to sort of give the middle finger to somebody's parents or pastor or church. It's not about that.
I agree. Well, the book is The Ex-Evangelicals, Loving, Living, and Leaving the White Evangelical Church. It comes out March 19th. Sarah, it was so good to have you. Where can folks find you? I mean, you seem to wear a lot of hats. You're an author, you're a journalist. Do you have a public presence? Where can folks follow you if they want to?
Yeah, I have my Substack is probably the best place these days. It's just Sarah McCammon, which is McCammon. It's free to subscribe. And I have all the information about my book there as well.
Awesome. I love it. Well, let's definitely keep in touch. And thank you for your time. I'm excited to read the book. And yeah, let's see what the future holds.
Thanks so much.